సహనౌ భవతు సహనౌ భునక్తు సహ వీర్యం కరవావహై తేజస్వినావధీతమస్తు మా విద్విషావహై ఓం శాంతి శాంతి శాంతి.
See what we have today. All of us here and so many people in the world, do we share the same self? Just many people aren't aware of it. Exactly. There's only one self, and hardly anybody's aware of that. to be aware of that, you have to be a mumuksha, right? But it happens to be the fact of it. But then every living being in the creation suffers from that beginningless ajnanam, self-ignorance, because all of the means of knowledge that we have are only directed outward. So there's this, what we call this mutual superimposition, that's a natural result of that ignorance. It's called that anyonya adhyasa. And that's where the mind itself takes itself to be one with the self, because wherever the mind is, the self is. So that, why would it not think that it's the conscious being? It needs some means of knowledge to differentiate the subject-object differentiation. But the mind can't do that on its own, because from its own experiences that it's just a conscious entity. It's once a means of knowledge is directed at it, then it's something obvious. But until that means of knowledge is utilized, it just assumes that it is the consciousness, and the consciousness is it. So it's a kind of an unavoidable mistake, but it's easily rectifiable with the means of knowledge. So yeah, we're all just one being. Past, present, and future. And all of the worst people in the world is you. It means there's hope, because the self is pure, you know. The self is pure, and it's just nothing that can be done to hurt it in any way. So there's just, if some people get too deeply into a dharma, they just have to work their way out over the centuries of lifetimes.
What happens with different forms of mysticism? Like, they arrive to the same point, the unity of one single self, but through a non-cognitive path? Or which differences you would point out between?
Well, you have to kind of know the different traditions to point out the differences, but and in kind of a broad strokes, you can say that, say there's the universe, or the expression of reality, what all that is, you know, is what is experienced by all of us. What is experienced by all of us, all human beings, you know. And so those experiences are defined differently by the different religions. One thing I liked was Houston Smith, who was kind of a theologian philosopher who wrote a lot for academics. He wrote I can't remember this guy's name, who was a theologian. He wrote an introduction to this particular theologian. I'll probably think of his name. His book was called The Transcendental Unity of Religions. And Houston Smith wrote the foreword to it, and he made a triangle, and at the top piece of the triangle were the mystics of all of the religions, and at the bottom there were all these different theologies, from Christianity to Judaism to Islam to Buddhism to just whatever we could say, Vedanta, yoga. There's about five, maybe six or seven, eight of them lined here, all different theologies. And so he was pointing out in his introduction that all of the theologies are just different forms of worshiping God. And they're very, very different in the way that they worship, or the way that they visualize God. Like if you go into a Hindu temple, or even into India, all of the pictures of all of the deities, even pictures of Ishwar with many, many arms. It's very different than if you go into a Christian church or you go into a Jewish synagogue. It's all so different. But if you get into or talk to the mystics of any given religion, the mystics are the ones who are seekers. What they want is really a direct, immediate relationship with God. Mm-hmm. They want to know God. Right? They don't want to just worship a God they don't know. They want to actually experience God, have a relationship with God. And so then, when you start reading the mystics of any given tradition, then there's deep similarities. There's differences, but they're all talking about kind of the same. They're all kind of in the same space. And so now in the East, they use the example of the 10 blind men and the elephant. You heard that one? Probably. There's a big old elephant, and there's 10 blind men, and they all go up to feel the elephant, to see what the elephant is like. And so one describes the elephant as a tail, and one is a foot or a leg, and the other one is a trunk, and the other one is ears, because they're just having kind of it's what they're saying is true about what they're experiencing. They may not be experiencing the elephant as a whole, is all, you know. And so it's not like all of the mystics are saying the same thing, but they're talking differently about the same experience, even about kind of conscious being. You know, like Buddhism talks about what we would call Brahman, but they talk about Brahman in a different way, contextually different, a different way to realize it. But what they're realizing can't be something different than what they describe. Their description is so much as Brahman. The Sankhyas are also describing Brahman. Non-dual within itself, conscious being. But they're defining it from their own what they've arrived at through their own logic, and so they, and in harmony with the Vedas to some degree, they think that they're in harmony with the Vedas anyway. But they describe it through logic, and what they're describing is that your pratyagatma, your innermost self called the Purusha, is pure non-dual from within itself, infinite conscious being, you know. Meister Eckhart talks about God, and so does St. Thomas Aquinas, as the absolute. St. Thomas Aquinas is the absolute simplicity of being, which to me is Brahman, you know. And then Meister Eckhart he's like a Christian Vedantin. And Rudolf Otto, was himself a mystic and also a writer, theologian, he wrote a book called East Meets West. I think that's something, East Meeting West or something like that, or the Meeting of East and West, something like that. And what he did was do a comparison between Shankara, who's the commentator we all revere in terms of Vedanta and use, and Meister Eckhart, who was a Christian mystic. And he put side by side the different quotes and did a whole unfoldment on that. And they were very, very similar, you know. So, Teresa of Avila wrote the inner castle. She had like a journey toward the innermost castle. And when she got into that innermost room chamber, she said, "I know theologically this is not how it is, but when you get to that inner chamber, there is no difference between God and yourself." I know that's not how it's supposed to be, but experientially, that's really amazing. So if you study the mystics, you'll see so much Vedanta in it, even though there's differences, theological differences. And a lot of them, like in especially maybe in Christianity, it's much of it is based on faith, and so there's not a real unfoldment. There's not something that we call moksha or liberation. in most of the Western religions, there's more salvation, where you live a good life, and maybe as a Christian, say you accept Christ or these kind of things, and that becomes the saving grace that at the time of your death you'll go to heaven. You won't really know what heaven is. It's just kind of the sitting in the presence of the divine. They define it very in certain ways, but with no real unfoldment. If you go back into the Gnostics, which are more ancient and they're kind of Christian based, there's more unfoldment, there's more teaching. Whereas if you were to read the Bible, it's more parables and things like that, you know. But you don't sit in the Bible, you don't sit down, you know, and have an unfoldment about the nature of reality. But there are many parables and things like that. So, the best thing, if you want to do some comparisons, is not to pay so much attention to the dogma or the main scriptures, but look to what the mystics of the different religions say, and then you'll find really things to compare and say, oh, this is how they say that, and that type of thing. It's kind of a nice experience. Is that good enough? Okay. I did that one. Can you please explain the difference and commonalities between Upasana Nididhyasana and Nididhyasana? Well, usually when the overarching term is dhyanam. Dhyanam means almost any really type of meditation. So the meditation can be like, for instance, Upasana, we'll divide Vedantically, Upasana, Nididhyasana. Nididhyasana is the type of meditation we do once we've been exposed to this knowledge. Right, so the pramana has taken place, you have some recognition of yourself, and on that one that you have that recognition that takes place at the time of teaching, you do, at the time of shravana, you do nididhyasana contemplation on that self that you've already recognized. So you, in other words, you know what you're contemplating on. Whereas in many other forms, like New Age forms of meditation, or even it's even true, I think, for yoga, you use meditation in order to have an experience of the self. So you don't know what the self is. You haven't recognized it at the time of teaching when the pramana is working. But you use meditative techniques to arrive to that self-experience. So for us, with Nididhyasana is not that. Nididhyasana is the self that I recognize at the time of teaching. Even Nididhyasana takes place during the teaching, where that unfoldment is taking place, and I see. Or when we do a guided meditation, sometimes that way the guided meditation goes, it takes me to that recognition. Or when I'm doing Shravana, it takes me, I just see. You know, like a blink of the eye, like I said, like just a blink, boom, I see it. And so that that what I recognize at the time of teaching, or get an inkling of anyway, that's what I contemplate on. And so when we do meditation, say we're sitting for meditation in the morning, and right now we have been doing like you can do inner child work, you make your body very relaxed and comfortable, you can do some pranayama like we're doing now, you can do inner child work just to settle down the upadi, the body-mind center, and settle down the unconscious, and bring shanti, relative shanti to your mind. And then you turn your attention more to the self that you've recognized at the time of teaching. It's kind of like the text that we did yesterday and today, this morning. You as though turn your attention toward the self. That's really the very adhisthana of the mind. So it's a funny thing, the mind is turning toward its own being, and there's no distance between the mind and the being. That's why they say you can't really, it's just almost, we do it, but that's not really what's happening, something like that. And so then you sit and get to know yourself rather than being yourself as one with the mind, you've differentiated yourself and you realize yourself without all these upadis, without the body and the mind and the sense organs. You recognize yourself as the adhishtana of all of the thoughts, or just focusing just on your own being and getting to know yourself, as opposed to getting to know who you actually are rather than who you are being mixed up with all of these upadis. It's the same self. But you're used to recognizing yourself only through the lens of these dresses. So your mind has to get used to being with yourself, to recognizing yourself. Because yourself is always present. It's just always seen through the upadi, together with the upadi, not separate. So nididhyasana has to do with owning up the self you've recognized at the time of teaching. Upasana. Upasana is when we're... Well, there's two types of upasana. There's the upasana where I'm still the jiva, the knower, you know, the one who has a relationship with Ishvara. And then I'm having a visualization, either the visualization of my Ishta-Devata or of a Devata that I feel, you know, a relationship to. I'll do a visualization, or I'll do a visualization of the whole universe, or I will have learned some very particular upasanas, there's many of them, which is kind of a very well-defined visualization. They tell you see like the sun is the eye of Ishvara, that type of thing, and the earth is the feet, his feet. And then I don't remember all, there's some beautiful ones in the Brihadaranyaka. And Chandogya have a lot of upasanas. They'll define this, and then you learn that, and then you hold that in your mind, and you just worship it as Ishvara. You know, you meditate on Ishvara in that form. But the subject object is still there. I'm the devotee, you know, who's meditating upon Ishvara in this form, and there's certain punya and shanti and strength that comes from doing that. Just from doing that upasana. But for the jnani, that still is nididhyasana. It's still resolving only into Ishvara, which is only Brahman. So there's no, I resolve the subject object, and I resolve the seer seeing or the devotee in Ishvara to just recognizing all of this as Ishvara. So I can have my own visualization of Ishvara. And then I resolve this sense of knowership into just consciousness itself. And so I just abide as Ishvara, as a conscious being. It's a different type of nididhyasana. Still non-dual, because there's no difference between satyam and mithya. And so the visualization of Ishvara is mithya. In terms of the form, the self of Ishvara is Brahman. So really, all that is Brahman. I can say it either way. All that is Brahman, or I can say all that is Ishvara. If I say all that is Ishvara, I'm including this Maya manifestation of knowledge, which is mithya and has only my being, myself, for its being. Myself means the self of Ishvara, which is myself. So nididhyasana has to do with normally a subject object, devotee, you know, devotee Ishvara, meditation, where I'm worshipping or meditating upon I, the jiva, am meditating on the form of Ishvara, or form of the devata, upasana. Nididhyasana is when I'm resolving everything into Ishvara, or resolving everything into the self. Does that make sense? Would you recognize a jnani from the way he speaks and the words she uses? From the attitude, what would be clear enough signs that they have self-knowledge for you? Well, you know, in chapter 12 of the Gita, Chapter 12, and also chapter 2 from verse 52 to the end. These are all giving the gunas like the qualities of a jnana, of a jnani. And so that's kind of nice to read. You know, like the one who has friendship toward all beings, and it's just all, I don't remember all of them, but it's nice. Also in chapter 13, I think it's something like verse 6 to 10, in chapter 13, again, it's all qualities that we will meditate on and practice, like amanitvam, adambitvam, all these, ahimsa, kshanti, adajvam, value of values went through all those. So, you can, it'd be nice, I mean, if all those qualities are there, those are also saintly qualities, so they're not necessarily a jnani, but a jnani should have those qualities, but may not. May have them internally, but you may not see all of those. You may see a few other things, too. So, I mean, hopefully there's a certain amount of patience and kindness and, you know, a certain amount of containment. You know, it was just abiding. There should be something like that. But you know what? The person who gave Swamiji knowledge, that
Swami Pranavananda.
Yeah, Pranavananda. He was really cranky. And in fact, when he was teaching with Swamiji, and there was only, you know, a small group of students there, like 10 or something. I don't remember. Just a small group. He was giving that class, and this one student would fall asleep in the class. And so Pranavananda threw a bucket of water on his head. Class is not for sleeping. But you know what? This guy, he had this knowledge and he could wield it. He wielded it as a pramana. But he was a little cranky. He hadn't done all of that type of work, you know. Well, maybe he was fine with being cranky. So I would say, if I wanted to say, what really, if a person is really a jnani, and a jnani means they have both brahmanishta, means that the self is not at all hidden from them. Your own being is self-evident. And your being as Ishwara is self-evident for you. So there's that, that's brahmanishta, and then that's a given. And also that you have that shrotriyatvam. That means that to be a brahmanishta and a shrotriya means that you can handle the pramana to make another person see. And so that would probably be the best. If that person can make you see, then they most likely see themselves. But that also isn't necessarily true. Because a person can be, like in India, what we call a pundit, and they're a householder and living their own life, but they have the shrotriyatvam. They have studied all of the Vedas and all of the commentaries, and they probably have listened to swamis and all of this, you know, to teachers, because that's their commitment, you know. But they'll tell their students, This is what the Vedanta, this is what the Upanishads say. I haven't realized it myself, but I have studied it, and this is what they say. Okay, so they don't make any bones about it. They don't try to be a jnani, you know, to like a mahatma, or they're a sannyasi who has self knowledge. They'll say, no, I don't have it, but I have studied all of this, and I can teach you what it says. They say something like this. It's Swamiji's version. And so now the thing is, if the student is a mumukshu, and the teacher is teaching all of that, even though they may not have such clear knowledge, your mind is ready and waiting, you know? And so you can get that knowledge even if they might not have that clarity. And the reason they wouldn't have the clarity is they're not quite ready for it. You know, they want this and that out of life, and they like they're living their life, and they're not ready to really focus in on that type of thing, but they have this panditjam, you know, scholarship, and they've studied very deeply, so somehow that knowledge gets passed. So otherwise, I think probably the most real answer is that you don't really know, and it's Bhagavan's grace. It's just Ishwara, it's called Ishwara Anugraha. because you're a mumuksha, you can count on Bhagavan taking care of you and getting you to the right person. That's a, you know, because if you start to think, well, you know, a jnani should do this and do this and do this and act like this and act like this and act like this, it's not really, I mean, that, some of that will be there, but that still doesn't mean they acknowledge. And then you've got a cranky one that was, you know, liberated Swamiji, you know. So it's hard to, I would just take it honestly as Ishwara Nigraha. Grace of Bhagavan because you have the mumukshutvam. And then if that person makes you know, that's good enough. If that not, but the reason they can make you know is because their teacher made them know. The handling of that pramana. But there can even be some exceptions to that. You know? Like if you're really a mumukshu and the person has that panditya, but means that scholarship and knows those, knows what Shankara and they all are saying. So. Yeah. Grace of God. You have to, yeah, that's good enough. You just have to, that knowledge has to be able to pass between you and your teacher without that obstruction. So, otherwise that person's not your teacher. Could you define and clarify the differences between upasana and nididhyasana? Really? Hey!
Popular question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Same question. Same writer. Maybe. Whatever, it's a good question. So. Talking about Ishwara's order. We make so many unconscious choices in life due to inner children wounds and backgrounds. Sometimes it feels like choices made by the unconscious mind are wrong, but I guess they are not. It is Ishwara's order also to make the choices that feel like a mistake. Also, how we choose relationships to heal, support Ishwara's order. Well, there is such a thing as free will. But then it's also true that our unconscious things that rise up can also kind of distort your behavior a little bit. And so, but then when it does, say you're kind of acting out something that is really more just an unconscious, more stuff coming up from the unconscious, you're in some way acting that out or projecting it onto the world, you know, then you have to, well, let me put it this way, that doesn't work, and you know it doesn't work, and so you have to assimilate your experience, you have to analyze your experience, you know, and you have to change the way that you're, you have to learn to change the way that you're behaving because it causes so much pain. And so pain becomes the great teacher, you know. So even if you're making mistakes and wrong choices, you learn from the pain that it causes you. It's like, we always use the example of putting your hand in fire. You know, you do that once and you probably don't do it again. Or maybe you do it a couple more times. Experimenting. You know? But we really learn from our pain. It's kind of one of our best guides, actually. You know, and so if your relationship with somebody or the way you treat somebody or anything is causing you pain, then you have to go inside and see how you could be different in that situation. Because you can always change yourself in the way that you respond. You can't have that much luck changing other people. They have to work on themselves. But I find that we can change the way we are so that other person and the way they are is not a problem for us. But you have to learn, you have to experiment with all of that, because say a person is problematic, causing you a lot of pain, or, you know, is aggressive or whatever it can be, you may try to push back in a particular way, and that pushing back will just cause you more pain. I'm not saying that you don't have to set up boundaries. We have to set up boundaries, and, you know, there's certain actions that we have to take, but we have to take them compassionately. You know, we have to treat others like we would treat ourselves. So that's, say if somebody's a problem to you, they just are a problem, then what if you were that person? How would you want to be treated? Because boundaries have to be set. You have to go your own way, probably, or whatever. But how are you going to handle that with that person? You know, you can be cruel, you can be mean, you can be all kinds of things, or you can do it in a way that you would like them to do it with you if there's some problem. And so you always have to kind of think of how you would want to be treated, just as a habit. Not that I do that all the time, but I do pretty much do that if I need to. That's so much, because if you don't do that, you will suffer. You know, it's because that's your kind of, your behavior is not appropriate, even if the other person's behavior is really not appropriate. You know, that person will also suffer from just the what do you call it, the feedback or something. I can't remember the word for that. But by them being inappropriate, they'll suffer from that. Just by the laws of Dharma, it just happens, and that teaches them also. And so you just, as time goes on, as lifetimes go on, you become kinder and kinder and kinder, because that's what works for your own shanti. You can say, "Well, I'm getting kinder because I'm a really kind person," but actually, you're just learning from our mistakes. In terms of our own peace and our own love and our own feeling of being loved and our own freedom from isolation, feelings of any own loneliness or isolation, it all has to do with giving. That's just how it is. So even though that's hard sometimes, in the end, that's, your heart has to be as big as Ishwar. Even when I was reading this last, I love that when Swamiji said that. It's one of my favorite things. Your heart has to end up being as big as Ishwara's. And he said that in this book, the last part of the very last part of the Kena Upanishad. And that's a big thing. Your heart has to be as big as Ishwara. That means every being is yourself. And so that's a challenge. You know, very very difficult to even conceive of that if you don't have self-knowledge. Because you have self-knowledge, the ananda that you're seeking, or the wholeness of your seeking, is already your own being. You know, so there's nothing for you really to achieve. You already are that. The problem is that because of ignorance, our mind is small, needy, you know. Needs this, it thinks it needs this so I can be happy, and I need this, and I need this so that I can be happy. And then I can't rule the world. I can't tell everybody how they're supposed to treat me and what things are supposed to come my way, because I want them, you know. It's not how the world works. You know, because I think we'd all like to, let me just be the center of my world, and then everything is for me. All is well, okay? But that's not at all how it is. Yeah, so that's why we become mumukshus. It's almost like saying, how can I be who I know I'm supposed to be, what I am, because you get glimpses of it. But you keep losing those glimpses, because the mind doesn't know where to go or what to do. So finally it kind of realizes in a very real way the situation we find ourselves in, and then asks Bhagavan, please just save me.
You know what I really meant by that question? It was more, I mean, earlier in life, when younger and didn't know anything about psychology or what drove me to take this and this decision, or why did I want to achieve that or that. That's more what I mean. Oh. It's like, it feels like that was.
That's kind of the power. It's a setup. It's the prarabdha. Yeah. Because the whole life, from taking the birth to the parents you have to the place that you're living to the major interests, that's all karma. That's why you took this birth. And so that, and that's very natural to you. That's the natural unfoldment. Even though there's punya and papa that are thrown in there, and that natural unfoldment is still your life, the unfoldment of your life. And so your choices are directed in that way by the very karma. Remember, there's three ways that we are pulled through the karma. And one is swecha, swa-icha, one's own desires that rise up. That's part of the prarabdha also. And then anyecha, anya-icha. Icha means desire. Anya means another's desire, pulls you. The other is just the natural situations that happen in the universe or in your society, in your where you live, in your prarabdha. Pulls you forward. It's not a given person or your desire. It's just the situation that arises, like the volcano in Bali. Everybody's affected like that. 100,000 people have just been told they have to leave. Not because anybody wants to leave, not because somebody wants them to leave. It's because of the volcano. They have to go right away, you know. That's anicca. Nobody's desire. It's all Ishwara. So these are the things that are moving us through. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So you have to. I think a good way to understand prarabdha is to look backwards at your life, and you see kind of a meaningful unfoldment. What is the job or role of the ahankara from the standpoint of Ishwara Srishti as opposed to Jiva Srishti? How can I differentiate myself from the ahankara, both in meditation and everyday life? Well, the ahankara is the first manifestation of self-ignorance, which is beginningless. And so the ahankara is the very born of self-ignorance, the very natural propensity of the mind to take itself to be the conscious being. And so that is the I, it has an I notion. Right, consciousness illumines the ahankara, illumines the mind. It's free of the mind. So I'm not my mind. I'm not the mind at all. But from the mind standpoint, because of the sattva, it knows itself to be a conscious being, and that is the ahankara. I, the mind, am a conscious being. And then it'll say, and I'm living, you know, I'm part of this body. I'm in this body, as are my sense organs. And this body dies, so I'm going to be dying. I'll die. Because the ahankara, because of the sense of touch that pervades this body enjoys me too. The mind is conscious, sense of touch. Because of the sense of touch, the body is conscious. The sense organs are sattva, so they're all conscious. And they're also, because of my physical, you know, sense organs, it's all indwelling in this body. So I take on all of the qualities of the body. I take on the qualities of the sense organs, the qualities of the prana, the qualities of the mind. Because all of them enjoy consciousness, and I'm a conscious being. So that the ahankara is the natural product of ignorance, of self-ignorance. If I know myself, then that ahankara will still be there, but it'll be there as mithya. You know, I know what it is. And if I say I'm going to the store, I know that all of a sudden I've all of a sudden become my body who's going to the store. I'm just talking like a normal person. So. That's what that is. Notice there's more there. Oh, so from the standpoint of Ishwara Srishti, there's no problem. You know, it's that the problem is from Jiva Srishti. From Ishwara Srishti, I mean, if the ahankara is just a natural product of ignorance that is natural to this creation. But what's interesting there is what's also natural to this creation is self-knowledge. From a Hindu perspective, this self-knowledge, the Upanishads, the knowledge held in the Upanishads, which are really not Upanishads, they were the guru-sisha relationship that started with the rishis that had been handed down, where these dialogues have been handed down from beginningless time. And so knowledge is also part. Self-ignorance is something that all of the jivas suffer from, and you know, but then they, at some point they realize they're suffering from self-ignorance, that they don't know what's going on. And then at that time they become mumukshus, and then there's knowledge. There's also self-knowledge. So that's all Ishwar. The Ajnanam is Ishwar and the self-knowledge is Ishwar. And the jiva srishti is all of the kind of the flailing around of the jiva who's subject to that ignorance. Jiva srishti means the jiva's creations, all of the projections that we have, all of the subjective experiences that we have is jiva srishti. Like say, even without just going into the unconscious and the wounding and the ignorance, any, say all of us, for instance, all of us have a mind, all of us have hands, all of us have legs, all of us have the Ishwar and Upadi that is following the Ishwar's blueprint. But then we fill it up with a lot of different things. Like my mind and unconscious are filled with all kinds of subjective experiences that are different from what fills up your mind and your unconscious and all of your perceptions. We can perceive, but all of our perceptions are different, you know. We can hear, but everything we hear is different. So those are all subjective. Those are what we call the jiva srishti. They're the things that we create, even everything that's in our mind, in our memory. Those belong to us. All of our projections, you know, the projections that are brought about by ajnanam, by ignorance. It's all jiva srishti. Jiva's creation. But really have to think about it, we call it pratibhasika. It's those things that are not shared experiences. Like this room is a shared experience. But what might be going on in my mind is different from what's going on in your mind. It's not shared. If I see a snake on a rope, I'm probably the only one seeing that. You know, that's not shared. It's a projection. So that's the difference there. How can I differentiate myself from the ahankara? Well, I think that with knowledge, the ahankara, the false identification with the body, mind, sense organs is something that is changed as you gain knowledge. Because now the ahankara is that mistake of taking myself to be the body, mind, sense organs, or anything I call an upadi. Right? I take myself to actually be that. That's the ahankara. When I gain knowledge, I recognize all this is mithya and I'm just pure conscious being, Satchitananda Atma. And so the ahankara becomes mithya. It doesn't go away because you still have a body to deal with and a mind that thinks and sense organs that are functioning. You know? So you keep the mithya eye, it's not a real eye. So, how can I differentiate myself from the ahankara, both in meditation and everyday life? Well, meditation and everyday life is probably the same. It's just the continual recognition of myself. That's why nididhyasana meditation is good, because I'm so used to that identity with the upadi, and now I sit with myself, or during the day I just bring my mind home to my knowledge, and I recognize always kind of my own silent me that is ever the same. And then there's the changing thoughts and the changing body and changing emotions, but abiding changelessly in all of that is just me, who I'm just self-evident me, and that's ever-present. But initially I have to kind of bring my mind home to that, because I'm not used to that viveka. I see it at the time of teaching, and I walk out the door and the reeds, you know, kind of close over. So it's only after some time that becomes stronger, that knowledge becomes stronger, that self-recognition becomes stronger than all of the samskaras I'm bringing with me, born of self-ignorance. So, this might be the last one. If we were to find Sankhya followers and you were a Sankhya teacher, wouldn't we find a mistake in Advaita Vedanta? how one knows that the teaching is correct indeed is not being disprovable a good enough proof. Tomorrow. Good question. But it requires too much of my brain. Let's see if this one does. I'm happy to do it, though. It's a good question. Yep, I'm done. Nothing wrong with the questions, I promise you. It's my mind. It has decided that no more is to be done tonight. Yeah. It's quite honest. Om swastika jabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha ko brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini Desho yamsho bharahitaha brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu sarvesham shantir bhavatu sarvesham purnam bhavatu sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pasyantu, ma kaschit dukha bhak bhavet, asato ma satgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya, Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om